Wow. Let's make sure the sound works. How's that in the back? Is that okay? Please adjust your chairs if you like to improve the sight line. And we toyed briefly with the notion of sitting, having me up on the dais here, and it was just too uncomfortable for me. Maybe for also for the people in the very front here. So we shifted into this as the least bad option. I think in many ways that's the nature of wisdom, right? It's it's giving up a lesser good for a greater one. So that's actually pretty profound when you think about it.
Rick, there are some people who can't hear, so we could just turn that
Any off. Idea about the sound, turning it up? I can raise my voice a bit. I do tend to... What? Oh, okay. Great. I want to say a word or two. So first of all, that was a lovely introduction, and I'm not sure all of it was true, but I hope it's true. So we'll see if it's true. And with regard to today, I thought I'd say a word about what I hope to be up to today, and then clear away some sort of preliminary things to get comfortable, and then really dive in fairly quickly. I was sharing with Trudy beforehand that I have a background in rock climbing and some mountaineering, and I've got a friend in this room who knows about that. And one of the things you learn early on in that world is that if you don't get an early start, you don't get home by dark. And then suddenly you're in a world of pain and difficulty and maybe even a little suffering too. So I want to get an early start here. So,
I'm just going to ask you to put this up higher. That's all.
Even higher? How's that?
That's better.
How's that better? Okay, great. So reflecting on this topic and all, if you think about it, we all want to be happy. And we want our friends to be happy too. And we often extend that circle to wanting most people to be happy. And sometimes all people. And even all beings, all living beings. And even we even go sometimes all the way out to all beings in all realms all the time. You know, we have that wish, right? And yet the fact on the ground is that much of the time we're not happy. And by happy I mean both the ordinary happiness one gets when the 49ers finally win a game and the more, you know, profound human happiness when our child is born, we're with someone we love, or the sublime happinesses of, you know, spiritual awakening. And it's also true that we want to be helpful. We want to help others. We want to help ourselves as one of the beings we wish to help. And we also want to help other people and extend that help as far as we can. But we notice as well that often we're not happy and we're not that helpful. Maybe sometimes we're suffering or even harmful. And then we wonder what to do about it, right? And the reflection about what to do about it takes one immediately to the causes. Because if you understand the causes of things, it gives you, first of all, a sense of meaning and order, even if the causes suck. But at least you understand they're sucky causes, and you know why you're not in a good place right now. And they also take you, even more helpfully, I think, to what you can do about it. Because if you don't understand the causes, you're spinning in space, you're twirling, you're throwing darts in the dark, you're trying to figure out what to do. But if you understand causes, you can do something. You can go forward. You can be a hammer, not a nail, in your own life. You can be a cue ball, not an eight ball. You can be a cause rather than effect. You can initiate. And all the great teachers have really talked about that stance, the difference between the stance of just buffeted by life and trying to survive versus the stance of leaning into life and doing what one can, knowing that there's a lot that one cannot do. But at least you do what you can. So to do that, you need to understand causes. So here we are. We're humans, right? We have a body. No question about that. We think, we feel, we hope, we dream, we fear, we lose, we gain. And in terms of all the causes floating through our life, many of them are historical. Many of them are rooted in evolution. 3.5 billion years of life on this planet. The physical causes of the universe. Some of those causes are immediate, political, cultural, institutional, structural, and all the rest of that. Some of those causes originate with our own family background. Some of those causes are very alive today in our family background. As they say about practice, if you think you've attained something, go spend a weekend with your parents. Right? lots of causes, right? And a lot of those causes as well, you know, originate inside ourselves, inside our body, inside, you know, the imprinting of our history. The final common pathway of how those causes stream through into what we really care about, which is our experience of living moment to moment to moment, and our capacities to be happy and helpful. The final hub of the wheel, if you will, the intersection, the crossroads, that all those roads lead through to generate experience, to cause experience of living, and to leave a lasting residue behind, as we'll talk about, the hub of the wheel, the intersection of those causes, moment to moment to moment, is your nervous system, headquartered in the human brain. So one of the things I hope to talk about today and explore with you is the interaction and meeting and codependent arising of mind and brain together, forging, shaping, for better and for worse, our own experience of living moment to moment, our own happiness or suffering moment to moment, and our own capacities to be helpful or harmful moment to moment. And if one understands something about that final pathway, the hub, if you will, of the spokes leading into us of all these causes, moment by moment by moment, then one can start doing something about them. A major theme today will be how to use the mind to shape the brain, to shape the mind. In other words, how to use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind, to benefit the being and all other beings whose life we touch. And I have found, and I'm not alone in this, that the new breakthroughs in brain science, in which knowledge has roughly doubled in the last 20 years, combined with 100 years or more of thoughtful wisdom from psychology, clinical psychology altogether, and really illuminated by thousands of years of mental training in the contemplative traditions across all the world's great religions, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, shamanic traditions have a great contemplative wing, as well as Buddhist, the one that I'm most steeped in and trained in, and which has also had, just as a practical matter, the most intersection with Western science. When you bring together those three things, neuroscience, psychology, and contemplative wisdom, at the center of those three circles, you have really fertile ground for understanding the causes that shape us moment to moment to moment going forward in terms of happiness and helpfulness. And you have a lot of rich tools available at that intersection whereby you can understand better traditional practices that always worked. You don't need an EEG to get awakened, right? The Buddha didn't. Ramana Maharshi didn't. My personal view, Jesus didn't. You don't need an EEG. But on the other hand, by knowing more and more about the causes and conditions inside your own body, inside your own brain, you can actually do more to affect them and to be less at the effect of them and more at cause about them yourself. So that's what I hope to explore today. And I intend to cover a lot of ground. This is sort of a survey, if you will, of the mind-brain connection. And then in particular, I'm going to go after a very important capacity, which is fundamental to any path of insight, whether it's a personal growth path that's self-directed, or in psychotherapy, or in spiritual practice. And that capacity is to have a steady mind. Because if the mind is unsteady, if the spotlight of attention, if you will, you know, that continually illuminates things and also sucks it like a vacuum cleaner into the mind and therefore the brain, if that spotlight is all jiggly, it's really hard to hold it steady to see causes clearly. And it's also hard to hold it steady to do something yourself inside your own mind. So a little bit later, mainly in the afternoon, I want to follow a roadmap of the Buddha, who laid out a series of steps and factors for steadiness of mind. Think about what could be happening in your brain when those things are occurring and going well in your mind, and then figure out how to activate, or actually more than figure out, because I think I've somewhat figured it out, actually practice activating those brain states that promote wholesome mind states. Right? So we'll do that mainly in the afternoon. So we won't be able to, you know, it always happens that we want to do more than we can possibly do in the time that we have. So we just do what we can. I should add that it's a little bit about myself that's germane here. A while ago, I founded an institute, the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. It's kind of my institutional home. And it has put up a website called wisebrain.org that has all kinds of resources that are freely offered. We really see the mission of the Institute as to offer a basket of skillful means at the intersection of those three circles, right? Neuroscience, psychology, and contemplative wisdom. And so I will post the talks that I'm doing here, that I'm recording now, as well as the slide set. And there are many other talks and articles and slide sets and other resources, not just my own. I've kind of a greatest hits scientific papers in the public domain that are in that intersection that are pretty neat, as well as other cool things. And so you're very welcome to go there and see what's available for you there. I will cover a lot of material. It's in your slide set handout. You can also go to the website. Don't be alarmed if I go so fast or something that you just miss some of the stuff. It doesn't really matter. The essential things you'll really experience in the practices themselves.
Can you just repeat the website of this one?
So yeah, that's right. You're welcome to talk with me at the break. I'm going to be hooked and carried out of here fairly quickly when we end on time at 5 o'clock. Soon after that, I'll be zipped out of here by Trudy. So I won't be able to stick around then, but I will hang out during the breaks, and also you're welcome to contact me afterward. Okay? So let's talk a little bit. Let's see if the magic controller works. So I'm a guy with a remote control, right? Watch out. All right, what's going on here? Maybe there's a sight line. Deet-de-deet. Let's see if this works. It was working.
Yeah. He tried it, I know.
It was working. Maybe. How about you duck for a moment? Whoops. Hell, stay ducked. Thank you. Let's get this going.
Is it supposed to go to the projector or the computer?
No, it's right here. It's this sensor right in front there. So
okay. Which button is it? Maybe.
No, it's not going to work.
Well, let's see. Hang on.
Maybe it needs a new battery.
It was working. Well, how about you kick the next slide ahead, if you don't mind. Just right there. It should work. How about if you tap the space bar? We'll solve this problem. Well, that was good. What'd you do?
I'm not
going to
tell you.
All right.
But I don't know which way I'm going here.
You want to run it? You're sitting there, right? You're going to run it for me. So you'll figure this out, right?
I don't know how to go backwards.
Great. Okay, let's dive in. So. Yeah, that's forward.
It might work now. Maybe it was asleep.
There you go.
There we are.
Okay,
the remote might actually work now because the keyboard wasn't working initially. No.
Yeah. I think it went to sleep, Rick, so maybe
it was meditating.
Yeah.
Great. You might need to slide either a little to your right or to your left, either way. Okay, we're good. It's funny, sometimes when life is so complicated, it really helps to sort of zero in on a few themes or words or practices. And so I do that. Like, for example, I'll get a fortune cookie, ask a question and see what it tells me, and then sometimes go with that. Anyway, on a loftier plane, you may know that the what are called the paramis and paramitas, let's say perfections, if you will, of that are fully perfected and someone is awake, they're present in all of us to a greater or lesser degree. There are different traditions. There are 6 of them, and others there are 10 of them. Anyway, of the 10, recently I fastened on 3 in particular. One of them is patience. Patience is one of the attributes, really. It's perfected in an awakened being. So it's a nice thing to focus on patience. So I want to say a few words, and then let's do a practice and get into it. So one of the things we will do today is work with states of mind, because we're using the mind to change the brain to benefit the mind. And I personally think that there are 3 great aspects of any path of well-being or personal growth or spiritual attainment or activity. And those 3 are working with states of mind, being with states of mind, and transcending states of mind. Okay? Of those, I think I said them in the reverse order of importance. I think transcending states of mind, including having an intuitive sense of the always, already, all right ground of being, the mysterious and yet fundamental nature of what is arising moment to moment to moment, you know, that's fundamental, that's primary. Now, being with is also incredibly important. And a lot of mindfulness practice is about being with states of mind. You know, we be with them. We don't try to change them. We don't modify them. We don't try to fabricate anything in the mind. We simply be with what's there. That's an incredibly important capacity to have as well. Then there is also working with what's there. And there's no doubt that the Buddha, to use him as an example here, and I will certainly talk about Buddhism and Buddhist practice, there is no doubt that the Buddha put forth and encouraged many, many forms of working with states of mind. Wise effort, which is one of the eight pillars of the Noble Eightfold Path, or one of the main elements of, or eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, is about working with states of mind a lot, where we encourage the arising of what's beneficial and wholesome. In other words, we encourage the increase, the arising, and the maintenance of what fosters happiness and helpfulness, and we discourage, we prevent, we eliminate, we abandon that which fosters unhappiness, suffering, and harmfulness. So we're going to do a lot of wise effort today. Now, wise effort can be frustrating because you're working with states of mind, you're trying to do things inside your head, and sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. So I just want to warn you going in, you know, that's how what we're doing here. That's what I'm doing here, going after things. And so if you encounter some frustration with that, it's okay. That's just part of what there is minimally to be with, even transcend, or you can even, woohoo, work with frustration, you know, if it arises in the mind as well. So that's one thing. Second, when we do experiential activities, take good care of yourself. This is not a therapy session. It's not a group encounter. There's more value in the deep end of the pool, but make sure you can get back on your own. All right? And feel very free to modify the suggestions that I offer. Do what you know you feel you need to do. In particular, I will give fairly conventional or standard traditional instructions about tuning into states in the body. And for some people, that's great. For some people, that's alarming, particularly if they have any kind of a trauma history. So really take care of yourself in that regard. Ignore my instructions. Do something different. You know, bring your awareness to the Buddha up here in the front of the room, or look around, or look at the tree outside that window there. Whatever it is that helps you feel grounded and okay. Okay? So here we go. Let's see if this works. Yes, I love it. So a few disclaimers. The interest of informed consent. I'm going to talk a lot about neuroscience today. Neuroscience is an incredibly young science. As I said, knowledge about the brain has roughly doubled in the last 20 years. So there are so many things that they don't know. That also, of course, makes it a very exciting time. Obviously, brain science is no replacement for contemplative wisdom. It's not either or. It's, to me, both and. Of those three circles, people sometimes have different interests in different parts, different circles. Like some people are more interested in the psychology part or the neurology part or the contemplative practice part. It's okay to sort of snooze if you want during the other circles. On the other hand, it might be some pretty cool stuff there, but I will try to bounce a lot around all three circles and how they intersect with each other today. There are a lot of obviously important perspectives besides the ones I'm going to talk about, and obviously I come from my own view. You know, that's when, for me, been one of the great learnings I am on the path to acquiring through the Community Dharma Leader program about the diversity of views. A little later I'm going to talk about neurological diversity, which is a fundamental and objective kind of diversity rather than a more constructed set of distinctions between people that are often, in reality, not actually really very much there, like distinctions around race. They're socially constructed. But in any case, I'm a middle-aged guy, white, professional, married, two kids, one mortgage, one cat, you know. So partial in my view. So with that as a disclaimer, now we can really go forward. All right. So what is a thought? This is a great quote, from Ani Tenzin Palmo, who we were talking about at dinner. You know, it's really interesting here that, you know, we say, what is a thought? We don't know, but we're having those thoughts, you know, all day long. And, you know, I think even though I'm going to show you some really important, some really cool pictures that are sort of glamorous and scientific, I think it's important not to, you know, worship the cult of science, you know, the folks in the white coats. And so with that in mind, let's do a practice here. Okay? So I'm going to give you five suggestions in this guided meditation that are neurologically informed, and then we'll talk about why we're doing them. And then at the end of that, I'll ask you to do the best you can to follow each and every breath for 5 minutes. Each and every breath is about 75 breaths ballpark over the course of 5 minutes. It's okay if your mind wanders, but see what you can do to bring it back. I think of the five practices that I'm offering today, just right here, as, you know, an example of the larger theme, which is to offer a lot of tools, lots and lots of skillful means. And you'll find the ones that work for you. But it's really neat, I think, at the beginning to be exposed to a variety of tools, which is what a lot I'm going to be doing here today. And then you can see the ones that really do the trick for you. All right? So if you've never meditated before, here we go. I'm learning the right way to go. Whoops. There we go. It's very easy, actually. You're simply present to yourself. The trick is to sustain that presence to yourself, second by second, minute by minute, breath by breath. So relax. You can leave your eyes open or closed as you like. Come into your own body. Allow thoughts, sensations, sounds to pass through the spacious openness of mind, like birds moving across the sky, coming and going on their own. No need to resist anything. Moving through the open space of awareness, letting it be what it is. No need to chase after anything either, moving through awareness. Continually resting in the body, breathing. Comfortably settling into simply being here. And now I'll offer five suggestions with half a minute or a minute or so between each one. Do them as you can, and also be mindful of what's happening inside the mind as you pursue each one of these suggestions. The first is to form an intention for this sitting, perhaps in words, or perhaps wordlessly. You also might experience that intention as embodying the mind, the mode of being of someone you respect as a teacher. Perhaps someone in this life you know, or an historical teacher. Embodying their stance toward experience as a kind of intention. Exploring intention for this sitting, however you like. Second suggestion, and you're welcome to do this as well at your own pace and stay with a previous suggestion longer if you like. I'll keep moving along now. Second suggestion is to really relax. Focus on relaxing your body. For example, relax your tongue and your jaw muscles. Sit erect and stable so that you can relax the body. Take a big breath and exhale fully. Do another few big exhalations. With each exhalation, really relax. Third suggestion, bring to mind as much of a sense of safety as you can. Not perfect safety, but explore the process of helping yourself feel safer. Perhaps bringing to mind a sense of being in a protected setting, among good people. Perhaps bringing to mind a sense of your own strengths, your own capacities to deal, on the basis of which you can let yourself feel increasingly safer, more able to relax external vigilance, more able to bring attention inward. Noticing any fear of feeling safer. Allowing that fear to be present, letting it flow, and seeing if you can turn again to a gathering, growing sense of legitimate safety. Fourth suggestion, bring to mind, as you can, some positive feelings. Perhaps gentle and subtle ones. Perhaps a sense of peacefulness or gratitude for the good things in your life. Perhaps some happiness. Perhaps some warm-heartedness. Contentment. Perhaps a simple gladness at being alive. Notice any resistance or difficulty with finding positive emotions. Even subtle or mild ones. be mindful of that obstruction, if it's there, letting it be. It is what it is. And bringing attention as best you can, again and again, into positive emotion, even intensifying it as best you can. Letting it fill your body, perhaps quickening it with inhalation. For this moment, doing what you can to help yourself feel as good as you possibly can. All right, the fifth and final suggestion. Get a sense of the benefits, whatever they may be, of this meditation sinking into you. You're taking them in, letting them sift down into the fabric of your being. So, in their way, they will gradually nurture you and help incline your mind in an increasingly wholesome direction. Intend and sense the benefits of this sitting sinking into you. All right, and now bring awareness to the breath, the sensations of breathing, felt in the belly, the chest, the cool air coming in through the nose and down the throat, and the warm air going back out again. It's fine to breathe through your mouth, and I'll talk about breathing through the nose. You may also sense the breath at the upper lip. So for the next 5 minutes, as a kind of renunciation practice, let go of anything other than the sensations of the breath. Lay it down, drop it, like a heavy suitcase at the end of a long journey, and be present with the sensations of each individual breath from beginning to end. Following each breath, each fresh breath, for the next 5 minutes. How was that for you? Especially the experience of the five suggestions and whatever effects they had for you. What did you experience? Please. Thank you. All right. And yes, please.
When you asked us to think about our safety, it was a reconfirmation for me that I know my safety is in my vulnerability of my emotions.
Huh.
That we're safe there.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, please. Uh-huh, yes. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
Hey. Delicious. I will keep that. Especially the safety and relaxation. Brought tears of relief having permission to do this.
Wonderful. Thank you. One more person? Yes, please.
Two things. One was the safety thing, like a lot of people, I guess, maybe, that it's when you said that you are safe and able to deal with whatever comes up. I don't know exactly what you said, but just that, you know, being able to embody and feel this, like, belief, knowledge that I can deal with whatever, it was just amazing, and it was right. Very, very comforting. And the embodying of when you allowed us, quote unquote, allowed us to set our intention, not either in words or in, I don't know what words you use, but
nonverbal or embody someone who's an exemplar of that. Yeah.
And I was able to, that was very freeing for me, and I enjoyed that as well.
Very good. Thank you. Makes me happy, actually. That's great. How about one more for real on this side? You in the back there?
I'm also wondering if you would just quickly read the state of the five suggestions.
Sure. Actually, that's a perfect segue to, yes, what they were. And why I'm using them here, because I think they are skillful means. They're not the only skillful means. You'll actually recognize in each one of those traditional practices, which illustrates a broader point that very often the contribution of brain science is to highlight, you know, some methods out of the toolbox of 1,000 methods, right? And it's not that brain science invents a new method, although occasionally it does, and that is really quite interesting. But very often, it actually enables us to zero in on what really works. And also, in particular, as another major theme, to individualize practice for our own diverse neurology, if you will, our own body and our own needs, which I think is particularly relevant and important in householder practice. In other words, if you can do monastic practice where you're in the, I think of it as the rock tumbler, because I was a geology nut when I was a little kid. You know, you have these tumblers, right, and they slowly grind. It's like a soup can that just turns slowly, slowly. And it's amazing what you can put in there, right? You can put in there just a kind of a really blobby, yucco, brownish-looking bunch of junk, and slowly, slowly, slowly. And then, you know, a month or two or three or four later, you pull out this amazingly beautifully polished, you know, gorgeous blue crystal thing. That's kind of monastic practice. 24/7 grinding and polishing. That's one reason why the newsletter, the internal staff newsletter at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, sort of my home practice center, is called The Tumbler. Anyway, but we're householders. How much time a day do we have for formal practice? Not that much. So if we're going to do it formally and then get the benefit over the rest of our day, to whatever extent we can bring practice to the rest of our day, it's really important to be able to individualize what we do. If you're in the tumbler, it's just going to get you one way or another, especially if you're up for it and open to it. But as householders, it's very useful to individualize practice for our own situation here and now. And I think that's also one of the opportunities of neuroscience. So those are general points. With regard to the five suggestions, I would just want to walk through what was probably happening inside your own brain as you were doing that, which gets at a larger point, which is just, and I'll talk a bit more about this in a minute, it's this amazing fact that what you're thinking right now, what you're seeing, what I'm seeing, what we're all hearing, what we're sensing, or hoping, we're dreaming, we're fearing, whatever, all of that, absent a transcendental factor, and I'll talk about that X factor in a minute, is generated in your nervous system, headquartered by your brain. So it's really remarkable to just kind of get that these mental states we're having are, you know, certain kind of usage of the word, constructed literally by the 3 pounds of tofu right between the ears. So these are examples of that. So when you set an intention, in particular you're doing it top down with the prefrontal cortex. If you're doing it verbally, you're tapping the language centers that are on the left side of the brain for most people, certainly right-handed people and a lot of left-handed people, the left side of the brain. And also, if you are embodying an intention, as I offered as a suggestion, as a person who is an exemplar for you of practice, I imagine sometimes sitting like Jack Kornfield, or, you know, I don't quite go so far as to imagine sitting like the Buddha, but I kind of hope a smidge like the Buddha. And that just, ba-boom, moves you into a different zone. And that's bottom-up intentionality. Often we privilege top-down verbal intentionality, but a lot of very powerful intentionality is bottom-up in terms of the both felt in the body, but also rooted more in the emotional systems of the brain, in the limbic system. And a little later I'll do like a quick, you know, like the, I don't know what, the cliff notes of the cliff notes of the cliff notes of your brain, right? I like cutting to the chase, you probably noticed that already, and we'll do that about the brain. So I'll talk more about that in a second. That was what was happening inside your own head. You know, if you were in a scanner, they'd probably see some activation in the prefrontal cortex, lighting up a little like a Christmas tree, and then maybe something happening lower down in the limbic system, subcortical regions, brainstem, if you are more embodying it. And that's going on inside your own head. It's like a light show between the ears, moment to moment to moment. All right, second, relaxing, right? What that does is it activates what's called the parasympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system. So in our bodies, we have a part of the nervous system called the autonomic nervous system, which is the equilibrium regulator, maintainer, responding to the worlder, and kind of internal housekeeping. A lot of it is outside of our control. There's not much we can do about it. Parts of it, though, are under some control, and of the three wings of the autonomic nervous system, there's the enteric wing, which is rooted in your gut. You don't need to remember that. But then setting that aside, we have the sympathetic and parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, autonomic nervous system. The sympathetic wing is what happens when we get stressed. Fight or flight. That's the sympathetic wing responding. It also responds when we're really excited and enthusiastic. When our daughter, who's now 19, was playing in basketball, YMCA basketball, it's so cute to see these girls running up and down the court, their ponytails bouncing, you know, they're like 8 years old. Laurel would not take a shot. So we used a very skillful parental technique. We bribed her. We'll pay you a dollar for every shot you take. I don't care if they go in. I'll pay you a buck. And when she finally made a shot, and then when one finally went in, oh my God, was I excited. That's sympathetic arousal. So it helps us do all kinds of things. It's balanced, like in a seesaw, with parasympathetic activation, the rest and digest wing of the autonomic nervous system. When one goes up, the other goes down, relatively speaking. Technically, when the sympathetic arousal clears away, you know, parasympathetic activation is, which has always been there, becomes, relatively speaking, more prominent. In either case, it's like a seesaw. So we need that sympathetic arousal, right? But chronic sympathetic activation, hello, modern life, is pernicious for physical health and mental health long term. And I could talk a little bit more about that. On the other hand, parasympathetic activation, which is actually our home base. It's our resting state, when we're not in pain, when we're not threatened, and when we're not upset. Because, sidebar, when we're upset, we get sympathetic arousal. Get mad, get really scared, get really sorrowfully upset as well. Sympathetic arousal. So when we activate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system through multiple means, calming the body, exhaling, parasympathetic handles exhaling, right? When we do that, we downregulate the sympathetic wing, we get a lot of nice parasympathetic activation, the fires cool down. The Buddha, for example, talked a lot about how the world is on fire with greed, on fire with hatred. Either greed or hatred activates the sympathetic wing of the nervous system. If we want to come down to a more peaceful place, a more centered place, from which we can see the world much more clearly, we really want to encourage parasympathetic activation. The problem is modern life is like graduate school and sympathetic arousal. And we highly train it. And to pick up a theme that I'll be getting through a lot today, transient mental experiences, transient mental activity, ephemeral, immaterial psychological experience leaves lasting material traces in the brain. Neurons that fire together, wire together. That's the famous saying in neuroscience. Neurons that fire together, wire together. That's from the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb. So the point is, when we have chronic sympathetic activation, we're training the brain to move into fight or flight mode just very quickly. So it's no accident that across traditions, contemplative practice really emphasizes as a foundational capacity or support, resting and digesting. They didn't have a lot to digest a lot of the time, but at least they were, you know, trying to rest. In other words, parasympathetic arousal. So that's what you were doing when you did those exhalations especially. Third suggestion, turning to a greater sense of safety. That's a very interesting one. It's no accident, I think, to use the Buddha's own Night of Awakening in terms of the accounts that have come down to us, either literally true or metaphorically and nonetheless productively true. He had his back to the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree had his back. The threats that came to him in the form of Mara, the embodiment, literally or figuratively, of deception, illusion, because it is ultimately ignorance that is the root of suffering. As Trudy said in her beginning, those who see clearly are undermining the causes of suffering. Those whose clarity is obscured are, you know, lost in causes of suffering. So the threats to the Buddha came from the front where he could deal with them. In other words, there's a place for a growing sense of safety, relative safety, because there's no perfect safety in this world. That's a deep teaching. We have to come to terms with the absence of perfect safety. At a minimum, we're all exposed to three of the four, and actually in this setting, four of the four divine messengers. You know, the first three being, you know, disease and old age and death. There is no perfect safety, but it's possible to have a greater relative sense of safety. In that, I mentioned to be aware of any fear of feeling safer. Because for many of us, our personal experience is that when we felt safer and let our guard down, that's when they got us, right? Or that's when we saw them get somebody else and we had a vicarious trauma. So I just want to acknowledge that, you know, and that is something for people to work with in terms of a growing sense of safety. The brain is hardwired to scan continually. You know, we literally wake up about 10 times a night. We don't notice it to kind of check for predators and weird sounds around us. And then we go back to sleep. Try to walk across this room or a mall or a street without any molecule of anxiety. Very difficult. There are temperamental constitutional variations in how anxious we feel. And then, of course, life happens and makes us perhaps more anxious based on our history. So be it. But in terms of just the resting state, the hardwired, you know, resting state, the background hum of the brain, it's an endless tickle and trickle of anxiety, which then pushes attention out here. So if we want to bring attention inwardly, let's say, in terms of the internal states of mind, or to calm the mind enough to just see with great granularity the ebb and the flow, moment to moment, of experience and what causes things to happen, and even more deeply, the nature of all that. To do that, we've got to bring the sentinels in. right? They're out there in the parapets scanning for enemy troops. What's out there? And we got to kind of calm them down to bring those resources in. It's again, to me, again, no surprise that traditional instructions are to find a place of seclusion, in other words, safety, right? Establish mindfulness, a certain minimum necessary awareness of the surround, and then do the work that there is to be done right then and there. So that's safety. Next one was positive emotions. Positive emotions are great. You know, it's really interesting. When I came to Buddhism, I first encountered it through Zen in the 70s, and then encountered it also in more of a Vipassana tradition. And what was striking is at first you think of Buddhism as sort of dour and glum and ascetic. You know, its first truth is life's a bummer, you know, suffering, right? First noble truth. Ugh. But then when you start reading, actually, the best record we've got of what the Buddha actually said, as best we can, handed down in an oral tradition, and then finally leaving a surviving written record that is probably certainly several hundred years in its origin after the Buddha passed away. In that record, when you read it, you just see over and over and over again, the Buddha talked about happiness. He talked about gladdening the heart. As we'll see later, two of the five factors of concentration and absorption and the kind of runway to liberating insight, it's not the only runway, but it's a major runway in Buddhism to liberating insight. Two of the five factors, as we'll get into later, are about happiness. One is about bliss, or rapture, and the other is about joy in its entire spectrum. And that spectrum of joy includes happiness, contentment, and tranquility. Those are positive, right? Loving kindness is a positive emotion. We feel it in our heart. Mudita, sympathetic joy. I'm happy for your good fortune. I'm happy that you're happy. Those are positive emotions. Again, it's very interesting to reflect on, why are those skillful means? Well, they're skillful means for lots of reasons. One is they're motivating, right? If the path of awakening was a total drag and bummer, whew, it'd be tough to, it's hard enough to stay on it. It's motivating to absorb the rewards. I think a lot of the secret to life, in a funny way, is to help ourselves want what's good for us that we don't want yet. You know? It's easy to want what's good for you that you want, but to want what's good for you that you don't really want when the rubber meets the road, you know? Like, you don't really want to give up the second cookie or a glass of wine or, you know, snarky quarrel with your mate. Or, you know, yap at your kid, whatever, or grumble in your mind about politics these days. But you know, the truth is, you don't want to give it up yet, right? So how do we help our mind? How do we incline the mind increasingly in a positive direction? One way is to orient it toward rewards. Deep down in the architecture of the brain, it's really dumb. It's really mechanical and basic. It goes after rewards, and it avoids and it goes after the reward of the absence of pain. So we can help train the mind, which means training the brain, to increasingly incline toward those things that reward us for what is wholesome and helpful and leads to happiness. Right? Well, positive emotions do that. They are also really great in terms of they activate the parasympathetic wing, they downregulate sympathetic, but they also steady the mind. And I'll talk a little bit more about this, but a very interesting aspect of happiness is an activation of a neurotransmitter called dopamine that is very involved in gating what is in the field of awareness. All right? I'll say more about this a little later, but if you think about it, we're very interested in what's in the field of awareness. And if we're trying to steady the mind, and if we're also trying to, you know, become absorbed increasingly in something fairly unstimulating like the breath, right? How many of you are able to track 75 breaths in a row without losing touch once? There could be someone in this room. It does happen. But, okay, not that easy, but just 5 minutes, let alone 45. If we just want to stay with that, if we want to stay with the breath, if we want to stay with a mantra, if we want to stay with an investigation, if we want to stay with loving kindness practice, whatever it is we want to stay with, therefore, we got to care about what gates that, if you will, I think of it as kind of a meadow, if you will, the field of awareness. What's in that meadow, and how do we gate what's there? In evolution, it made a lot of sense to have that gate popped open really easily. And animals are ancestors who did, you know, practice. They were all like, wow, the light on the leaves. Just so, wow. So into that. Look really closely at the light on the leaves. We got eaten. Right? They didn't notice the slither, the shadow nearby. They got nailed. They got eaten. Right? So we have a mind that looks around endlessly. And the way that working memory or the space of awareness is gated is really kind of cool. It's a very simple mechanism, but it has a lot of implications. It works like this. Dopamine, steady levels of dopamine keep the gate closed. Now, where does dopamine come from? Dopamine comes from rewards. So imagine a monkey in a tree. That monkey's got a lot of bananas in this tree. Yum, yum. Dopamine is steady. Keeps the gate to working memory, the gate to the meadow of awareness, closed. No intruders come through the gate. But let's say then the amount of bananas in the tree diminish. The reward levels drop, dopamine levels drop, and the gate pops open, right? And then new information comes in, and the monkey starts looking around for bananas in other trees. And this is our brain, by the way, I'm talking about. On the other hand, maybe there's a bunch of good bananas in this tree, nice steady dopamine, but then a cute other monkey swings into the tree and a branch nearby. Like, whoo, new opportunities. Dopamine spike, whoop, gate pops open again. In other words, gate pops open when dopamine drops and also when it spikes. And that's a fantastic way and a simple way to help animals pay attention to what matters to them, right? Well, what happens when you're experiencing sustained levels of bliss or even subtle, sublime joy or tranquility or contentment or ease or what the Buddha said was the highest happiness, which is peace, right? Peace is the highest happiness. What happens when we're experiencing that? And as he said as well, it fills our body. Like one would want to, I'll update the metaphor, fill flour with water or milk to make bread dough, kneading the liquid into every part of that ball of flour. If we fill our body with the fullness of that positive emotion, as the Buddha encouraged us to do, we're getting high levels of dopamine. High, steady state levels of dopamine keeps the gate to the meadow of working memory closed and can't spike because it's hit its natural ceiling. Do you see? Very high levels of steady state dopamine, which map to high levels of steady positive emotion, even subtle and sublime ones, keeps the gate to working memory closed, which helps deeply steady the mind. Mm-hmm. Happiness is skillful means. Right? Last one. Oh, I should add actually one more thing. When we're happy like that, we also get norepinephrine. Norepinephrine is a it's a stress hormone, a neurotransmitter as well, but it's also used to brighten the mind. When you brighten the mind, it's a general orienting, alerting neurotransmitter. It arises in the brainstem. I imagine it myself as like a fountain, kind of showering up into the brain, you know, and lighting up, maybe enlightening, and orienting the mind. So that helps us stay alert, because sometimes it's kind of hard to stay alert, right, as we sit and do practice. Positive emotion helps us stay alert. It also does a very important thing. Remember I said that neurons that fire together wire together? They do, but there's certain factors that promote that wiring. So if we want to promote the wiring together, in other words, the building of neural structure in areas that are positive, one of the things that facilitates synaptic formation, these neurons wiring together, in other words, making connections, synapses are the connections, you know, among neurons. If we want to promote that, guess what promotes that? Dopamine. And norepinephrine promotes synaptic formation, right? Because it makes sense in life. You know, the animal would really want to notice that which creates a spike of dopamine, which is either a great opportunity or a great threat, right? You want that animal to learn about great opportunities and great threats that are embodied and embedded in the brain in spikes of dopamine. So dopamine promotes synaptic formation. So if you're trying to help yourself learn, one way I think about practice, the path of awakening, which is a progressive path that is full of sudden illuminations, you know, that come by effort and I think sometimes come by grace. If you want to help yourself go down that path, that's a path of learning, right? We're learning to turn away what doesn't work. We're learning to move toward what does work. I think a lot of the path of practice boils down to the Dr. Phil question, How's that working for you? Right? We try to see what's working for us. We try to do less of what ain't, and we try to do more of what is. We're learning. It's a path of learning. What promotes learning embedded in neural structure? Learning means change in neural structure. What promotes learning in neural structure? Synaptic formation, which is promoted by dopamine, which is promoted by positive emotions. Okay? All right. Last one. Opening up to absorbing the benefits of practice is a very important thing. I won't have time to really talk about this in depth. If you think there's a word in Dharma practice, bhavana, cultivation, it's a process of cultivating the wholesome and cultivating less of the unwholesome. We're changing, we're growing, we're changing. The problem is, through evolution, in terms of carrots and sticks, sticks are much more important to pay attention to, alas, than carrots. Because, if you think about it, if you miss a carrot today, if you miss a reward today in the harsh environment that our ancestors evolved in, you probably have another chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you miss a stick today, it's all over. No opportunity for a carrot tomorrow. And so there isn't what's in the brain called a negativity bias. There's a lot of research on this recently that is full of quite profound implications for everyday life. For example, how many of you in the room are psychotherapists, by any chance? Quite a few. Maybe others as well. I've heard about research that shows that on the average in a relationship, you need about 5 positive interactions to make up for 1 negative one. All right? 5 good ones to neutralize 1 bad one. I don't mean good, bad morally. I mean good, bad pragmatically. All right? In terms of what helps or what hurts. All right? That's a 5-to-1 ratio. Good to bad. Or similarly, people will do a lot more to avoid losing $100 than they'll do to gain $100, like in a research study. All right? So the problem is the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. It fast tracks the negative because you want that animal to always remember the bad thing. Whereas good stuff, just kind of flows through, whatever. So how do we really register the good stuff? It becomes incredibly important because even if life is mainly positive or a lot of neutral, you know, at the end of the day, of the 100 things that happen, what's the one we think about? It's the one snarky comment our friend made or someone made, the one guy who cut us off while we were driving, the one worry we've got about some meeting in the morning, or the one, you know, concern about a child. We worry about the one negative thing, if you will. Well, guess what? While we're focusing on that negative thing, just kind of mulling about it in the, I call it the simulator of the mind, where we run these little mini movies, those neurons are firing. And so they're wiring merrily along, right? And the result is a gradual sifting of the negative residues of lived experience down into what's called implicit memory, which shapes the landscape, the interior sense of what it feels like to be me, what it feels like to be alive. Also shapes our expectations, what we expect will happen if we do something, yes or no, or how other people will treat us, or what the future holds. It also shapes our interpretations about the past, how we shade our view. It really shapes our view deep down, particularly the views that are relatively unconscious, our embedded models of the world that we just presume are indeed the case. Implicit memory is extremely important. So then the question becomes, how do we manage this negativity bias of the brain, which is tilted against us? It's tilted for survival. It's tilted against quality of life. Mother Nature doesn't care if we suffer. She actually uses suffering to propel the engine of evolution. There's a, you know, one thing I did, and I've done a lot lately, and I did in the book, is I've tried to reimagine Buddhism, the core teachings of Buddhism, in the frame of evolutionary neuropsychology. In other words, why do we suffer? Why is suffering embedded in living in some fundamental way? For example, what are the causes and conditions in the brain that lead to suffering? And also, since the causes and conditions of suffering, the local, proximal causes of conditions of suffering are in your brain, that also is where the causes and conditions of freedom from suffering are located as well, the proximal causes and conditions. Which lets me make a really important point. There are, I think, basically 3 fundamental domains to intervene in if we want to make something better. We can intervene out here in the environment, including in our relationships. We can take action in our own physical body, and we can also intervene in the mind. Today I'm talking about intervening in the mind. It doesn't mean that the mind is more important than intervening in the body or intervening in culture and capitalism and politics and you know, getting a street light, you know, near you and all that stuff. It just means I'm focusing on the mind. All right? So the point is, though, if the proximal, you know, source of suffering is in the brain, that's also where the proximal cure is, or the, you know, what we can actually do something. So one thing we can do is really focus on taking in the good. When life comes along and there's a good fact, let's register it as a good experience. Isn't it true that so often in life good things are happening, but they don't move our needle? Someone says something nice to us, or we get something done, or we notice some good thing inside ourselves, nothing happens, right? Or even worse, someone is nice to us and we kind of push it away. They give us a compliment and we don't take it in, you know? The second thing we can help ourselves to do as a kind of concentration practice is to dwell on the good experience for 20, 30 seconds straight. It's kind of a threshold level that, as any school teacher knows, and by the way, I think school teachers have a special place in heaven. Well, a little shout out for school teachers, one of whom put me up last night. Anyway, my sister's also a school teacher. As the school teacher knows, and other people know as well, kids and people learn something best when, one, it's as intense as possible, two, it's embodied as much as possible, and three, it's sustained. Because those neurons that form implicit memory for positive experiences are just standard issue neurons, right? They're not turbocharged, fast-track negative experience neurons. So those standard issue neurons, you know, they need to fire a long time, right? And they need to fire intensely, and they need to have a lot of inputs to really, really stitch neural structure together. So that's the second thing we can do. We can savor it. We can relish the positive experience, right? We can, again, rest our mind on positive experience. It's not that negative experience is not important, right? It's not that we should all be shiny, happy, smiley, facey people, you know, Pollyanna, rose-colored glasses, you know, Candide, it's always the best of all possible worlds. No, it's not. You know, I have a personal peeve with the phrase, he's just doing the best he could. No, he isn't. A lot. He could have done better. I could have done better. Whatever, you know? So the point is, there is a place, you know, for the negative. You know, it opens our heart, it turns us toward healthy remorse and all the rest of that. But on the other hand, look around, right? Look in the room, look at my face. Do you think the world is too few negative emotions? Do you want more negative emotions in your life? Do you feel like there's a negativity deficit? We can help you, right? We could share our negative emotions with you, you know? I don't know, I've never seen a hand go up when I ask that question. You know, do you really want more negative emotions in your life? And so the point is, by turning toward the positive, you know, the Buddha has a saying that whatever you rest your mind upon shapes the mind, right? Do we rest our mind upon the negative above and beyond what's true or useful, right? Or necessary? To whatever extent we're resting our mind upon negative experiences or negative information beyond what's true, useful, or inevitable, we are resting our mind upon the negative and increasingly shaping it in that direction, which is not useful for us, doesn't make us feel good, impairs us because those neurons are firing and wiring away, and it also makes us less able to give to others. I have a quote from Bertrand Russell in this. I gave a course yesterday and the day before, same course, different audience for therapists, called Taking in the Good. And there's a quote from Bertrand Russell that says essentially, the good life, as I conceive it, is a happy one. Not because good people are happy people, but because happy people are good people. It's not that happy people are always good people, or that unpeople are bad people, but as a generalization that has some wisdom in it, by cultivating happiness in here, by filling up our own cup, by putting our own oxygen mask on first, we have more to offer other people. Right? And again, I think that's very, very embedded in the Dharma. So when you did that practice of taking in the good, you registered a positive fact as a positive experience. Second step, you savored it, hopefully, you relished it, you turned toward the pleasure of it. And third, You let it sift down into you. You intended and sensed that it really sink into your being. And just that one little time, you put one little brick in the hole in your heart, right? One little bit of positive structure sifting down into the implicit memory systems. Okay? Those five suggestions also illustrate a broader point, which is that we can do things inside our mind. That's what you did. Those are mind activities. Those immaterial mental activities, because of the intertwining of mind and brain, which I'll talk about in a moment, actually shape neural structure, both in the moment and hopefully in beneficial ways in an enduring way. And that creates an incredible possibility that one can use the mind to change the brain to benefit the mind, which will then help change the brain in a wonderful circle full of possibilities. So any comments or questions so far? Yeah, in the back.
Can't dopamine be spiked obviously from doing something negative?
Yeah.
And so,
well, negative, what do you mean by doing something negative?
Something that is in the long term.
Like taking, like cocaine?
Exactly. Yeah, for a drug addict or overindulging or whatever, that, you know, there's an immediate spike so that you feel the pleasure, but
yeah,
in the long run it doesn't serve.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah. Choices.
Right. Great question. So first we got this brain, right? It could do all kinds of things. It can plan the Holocaust, right? It can say all kinds of nutty stuff on, you know, network TV about the way the world is. It could do all kinds of things. It can, you know, get blasted and dance till 3 a.m. Which, there's a saying, once a philosopher, twice a pervert. Because if you're doing a lot of things once, I've done a lot of things once, and more than once often, but doing it again and again and again, that's not a good use of the brain, okay? Or to quote Sokhne Rinpoche, a wonderful Tibetan teacher, he says, think the same thought over and over again, that's fine, but 10 times is enough, right? We can do the same thing over and over again. So your question then is, of course, how to use this brain for good, not ill, you know, for happiness, not suffering. Okay. There's so many ways, and we'll talk a lot about a lot of them today, so I'll just say one thing in particular. Actually, I'll say two things really fast. One is to have the intention to do that. You know the joke about how many therapists it takes to change a light bulb? Only one. But the light bulb has to want to change. It's stupid, but profoundly true, right? And so we have to want to change. We have to move toward intention. It's no accident, I think, that very early in the list of the, you know, the Eightfold Path, the elements of the Eightfold Path, there's first wise understanding, as Trudy said in the beginning, in a sense, understanding causes and results. And then the second one, right there, is wise intention. What is our intention? So that's the first thing. So make the intention to use this magnificent organ for good, not ill. A key point here. The brain is the end result of 3.5 billion years of evolution of life on this planet. 650 million years of animal evolution, 600 million years of the nervous system. The nervous system's been around for about 600 million years, right? 100, depending on how you define them, 120, 150 million years of mammals, 100 million years ballpark of primates, 2.5 million years of stone tool using ancestors, whose brains were a third our size. The brain has tripled in size in the last 2.5 million years. And then all these creatures evolving, suffering, dying in massive numbers. So the tiny little incremental benefits could slowly accumulate over time to end up in what science considers the most complex physical object in the known universe. More complex than an exploding supernova. More complex than global climate change. More complex than the American economy, even. God help us, right? So we, on the day we were conceived, we inherited this. We didn't earn it. You can't earn it. Who can possibly earn it? We stand on a pile of corpses. Sad and true. You know, the residues of that, and a lot of needless death, has accumulated up here. I'm not saying that it was intentionally done. Some people might think that the brain, there is some intentionality guiding biological evolution. I'm going to stay basically within the frame of Western science today. But merely in terms of biological standard issue evolution, whoa, a lot of creatures died so we could sit in this room today and have the brains that we have. So that takes me to two things, personally. One is to gratitude. Wow, a gift that can never be fully repaid. Wow. And the second thing it takes me to is responsibility. What will we do with this amazing resource we have? Will we help our life? Will we help ourselves? Will we help others? You know, or will we just let it be pushed around by all those currents of life that move through us in their final common destination at the crossroads, the hub of the wheel, you know, of the brain? That's the first thing. Second is to turn toward what's good. You know, turn toward what feels good. Turn toward the higher pleasure and turn away from the lesser one over and over and over again and incline the mind increasingly in that direction. Most of life is so little, right? It's this little stuff. It's the law of little things. As we go through life, right, we go like, this is our trajectory of life. At any moment, there's nothing we can do about the way it is. It's done. It's set. We cannot do anything about this mind moment. It's there, right? Once it bubbles up and stabilizes in the neural assemblies of the brain, it takes about a tenth, a hundredth of a second for it to do that, ballpark. Once it does that, it's set, right? It's congealed. Ba-boom. But we can do so much about the next moment. I love the phrase from Ajahn Chah, tending to the causes, or my way of putting it, watering the fruit tree, right? So in any moment, the range of what we can do is maybe this big, right? And sometimes it's down here. Sometimes it's way up here, what we can do. The question is, at any moment, are we going to do what we can at the high end or the low end of that range? You know? And any moment, that increment isn't very big between the high end and the low end of the range of life in terms of what we can do out there in the environment, here in the physical body, or in here in the mind, which means the brain. But the accumulation slowly of the choices we make, moment by moment by moment by moment in a life of practice, lead to a trajectory of life that's like this, right? Rather than this, or this, or in the case of some people who shall be nameless, who've recently occupied the White House, like that. All right? And so I think that's the bottom line. We do what we can, and we help ourselves increasingly lean toward the good while recognizing that it's not easy often. So we need all the help we can get. Because honestly, a lot of the currents that are embedded in the nervous system that had fantastic evolutionary payoff swim against wisdom. We have to swim upstream against these ancient currents much of the time to really progress on the path, which takes me actually to having more compassion for myself, more recognition of it's tough, and also more recognition, whoa, I really better get on my side. You know, I really better marshal some resources here to move forward against the stream. Part of the stream is helping us, to be sure, but there are a lot of eddies in that stream that are pushing against us as we move forward toward happiness and helpfulness. Okay. So I want to, if I could, move on. Then we ought to take a break in a little bit, right? And then maybe we'll think, too, about the temperature in the room. Seems a little warm for me. Of course, maybe. Okay. I grew up, actually, in West Covina, Southern California. So I'm used to heat and smog. Thank God you don't have the smog here so bad, at least. But anyway, so I'm used to the heat. But this room is getting warm for me. Okay. You saw those three circles? Okay. That's kind of where we're dealing today. I want to do a few little quick setups of information, and then let's take a break. All right? So, yes. As I said, I'm going to work in the frame of Western science. I personally think there are transcendental factors at work in the mind. I suspect that at the end of 300 to 500 years of science, which is how long I personally think it will really, really take to deeply understand the mind-brain connection, as well as people today understand molecular biology or quantum physics, because it's so complicated and so messy. And also you got human subjects that are a mess to work with. But anyway, at the end of that day, I personally think they're going to have to hold a big press conference that says, well, we finally figured it out. We've eliminated all possible causes inside the material nervous system for certain phenomena of human consciousness. And you know, guess what? There's an X factor. Right? I think that day may well come. It'll be a wonderful day. I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime. That said, you don't have to believe in the X factor. And for the rest of today, I'm going to talk without reference to the X factor. But I want to bow in that direction. It cannot be proven either way within the frame of Western science, so Western science should not rule it out. That's the genuinely scientific attitude, to accept it as a possibility. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's a famous saying in medicine and in science broadly. The absence of evidence for the transcendental, scientific evidence, if you will, is not necessarily evidence of absence. That said, this is a very important slide. This is kind of the, not going to do a lot of heavy lifting today, conceptually. This is one of them. We're going to get it out of the way. It's a good thing to get to. The basic idea here, which has been implicit in so much of what I've said so far, is this. Within the frame of Western science, there's a one-to-one correspondence between mental activity and neural activity. In other words, as I define it, mind is the flow of information through the nervous system. Much as a computer hard drive represents information, in other words, a physical substrate represents immaterial meaning, much as the material squiggles and random shapes, basically, they are just arbitrarily chosen on the slide there, the distinctions between the black and the white around it are physical. That's a physical substrate that carries meaning. If everyone in the room spoke no English, it would be meaningless. It would not carry meaning, right? But meaning is embedded in that physical substrate. In the same way, the nervous system carries signals. It carries information. In Gregory Bateson's wonderful definition, information is a difference that makes a difference, right? The more improbable an event, the more informative it is. The more random an event, in other words, the higher the entropy, the chaos, the disorder, the less informative it is. Right? So the brain carries informative signals that are not necessarily random or easily predicted. That's what it does. Most of the mind is outside the field of awareness, both in the moment and forever. Right? We privilege what's in the field of awareness because it's what we know, right? But it's not where the action really is. The Buddha talked, for example, so much about cultivation, about underlying tendencies, about uprooting the kleshas or uprooting the afflictions or the hindrances that afflict the mind. And those are deeply rooted in implicit memory, as I was saying before. They're rooted beneath the waterline. I don't know if you saw this little review I did for Tricycle magazine recently about this book on attention, and in which I said it's a great book. It's worth, you know, paying attention to. But on the other hand, she, like a lot of people, really privileged mindfulness and really privileged what's in the field of awareness. And I think that that's a bit of a trap, because so much of what matters is actually outside the field of awareness, in the shadows, which appeals to me as a guy who thinks Jung is the greatest psychologist ever. But anyway, okay, so the mind and the brain together, most of the mind is, you know, is below the waterline, outside the field of awareness. And where am I here? Oh, it's on the back side. I got tricked here. It's printed on both sides. Good. So therefore, as the mind changes, the brain changes. As the mind changes, as the brain changes, the mind changes, because they have this one-to-one correspondence. All right? Streaming through. The interesting thing is that, as I said, immaterial mental activity sculpts neural structure. And it does it in a lot of different ways. For one, if a part of the brain is more active than another part, it gets more blood and nutrient. Also, if neurons are firing together and thus wiring together, they are strengthening existing synapses and also forming new synapses. I'm going to show you a slide here of a meditator. This, I believe, is Matthieu Ricard, who's French-Tibetan monk. I think it's him. Translates for the Dalai Lama. He's looking this way. The part of the brain that's lit up, because it has about 3% more metabolic activity, it's using about 3% more oxygen. By the way, sidebar, when you see pictures of the MRIs, so forth, the parts that are lit up, it looks like the rest of the brain is dark. I kind of look at that actually as like a campfire at night, right? But the rest of the brain is very active. It's just that we have here a difference that makes a difference. 3% greater activation in a region called the anterior, which means frontal, cingulate cortex, which is a part of the brain that's involved in what's called effortful control of attention. It doesn't mean effortful like lifting the last weight, right? It just means effortful in terms of deliberate attentional focus. So Mathieu is in the MRI. He's doing boundless compassion, right? A non-referential compassion meditation, I believe. And while he's doing that very spacey thing, he's continually regenerating his focus there. And as he does that, that part of the brain lights up. It also lights up when we do anything with sustained and focused attention. Like, for example, sustaining attention to very careful gardening or complex handiwork, or watching our child, you know, in a potentially dangerous situation, but it's so far going fine, like initially learning to swim, say. You know, we're focusing our attention there. The interesting thing is that the continuing practice of meditation and contemplative practice, meditation, by the way, of all the mental activities in terms of neural impact, it's the most studied of all. Which is kind of neat, partly because it's sort of sexy, partly because scientists have sort of wanted to debunk it, and a lot because the Dalai Lama has been wonderful about supporting this. And by the way, a shout out here for the Mind and Life Institute. If you're inclined to be generous, generosity is a wonderful thing. Makes us glad, opens the heart, opens the mind, gives all kinds of benefits, and as the Buddha said, helps you sleep better at night. So in any case, the Mind and Life Institute is a wonderful target for your generosity. So you can see here in this slide examples of how routine, regular meditative practice, again, this immaterial contemplative mental activity, actually changes the brain over time. It thickens and strengthens the part of the brain that we just saw a moment ago. Now, the thickening is maybe 200th of an inch, but that's millions of new synapses. Just to kind of scale this, for example, there are, do I have a picture here? Yeah, I'll jump ahead a little, then I'll swing back. Have no fear, you do not have to remember any of this. This is a neuron, sort of. The cell body's on the left. Axons are like a little wire connecting it downstream to other neurons there at the right. It receives inputs, most of its inputs, into the cell body. It also receives inputs elsewhere, but they mainly come into the cell body. Those are called dendrites. They're like fingers. I kind of think of the picture at the top of the Sistine Chapel of Adam reaching to God's finger. I told you I wouldn't get transcendental. Can't help it. And right there at that little gap, it's like a synapse. You know, these dendrites in the brain reaching up and out. Anyway, receives signals there, shoots them down the axon. I'll say a little more about the physical, you know, kind of the 411 of the human brain in a minute. But the larger point is that, see that cell body? You could put about, in a human hair, pluck a human hair, put about 5 of those cell bodies in the width of a human hair. All right? That's pretty small, correct? You could put 5,000 synapses in the width of a human hair. 5,000 synapses in the width of a human hair. They're that tiny. So when you get an increase in neural tissue on the order of 200th of an inch through people who routinely meditate, you actually get a measurable difference, right? Another part of the brain that gets measurably thickened with long-term or continual contemplative practice is the insula. Insula is the part of the brain on the inside here. By the way, sidebar, there are almost always 2 of these things. The convention is to say them in the singular. In other words, there are 2 cingulate cortices. There are 2 insulae. There are 2 amygdalae. 2 hippocampi, blah, blah, okay? But we just talk about them in the singular. All right. The insula gets thicker, too. The insula is responsible for the interior sensing of the body. So when you're sensing your breathing or feeling into your body or being a dancer or doing yoga or, you know, really trying to improve your short game in golf, whatever it is you're doing, including paying attention to the movement of your joints, you're activating the insula. Interesting sidebar, the insula also is centrally important in empathy. In other words, to understand other beings, we resonate with them. And we do that in 3 separate systems. One is we resonate, we simulate their actions. Another is we simulate their emotions. The third is we simulate their states of mind. Of those, I think simulating emotions is pretty darn important. The part of the brain that does that is the insula. It both lights up when we feel something, particularly a more primary emotion, And portions of it also light up when we see someone else feeling that same thing, particularly someone we care about. Here's a takeaway. By doing some kind of routine mindfulness practice, whatever is your chosen method, in which one is tuning into the interior state of the body, one is strengthening the insula for interoception, but one is getting an extra payoff, an extra benefit, frosting on the cake, because you're also strengthening its capacities to be empathic with other people. Isn't that kind of cool? That is one area where I think brain science has offered a clarity about a new method, a great way to strengthen empathy. If we work with people who we want to help them become more empathic, or we have a partner we wish were more empathic, or our partner's telling us, you know, maybe we're spousal ordered into therapy to work on our empathy skills, right? A good way to do that is some kind of mindfulness practice of the interior sensations of the body. Point is, it makes the insula thicker. And in the interest of time, I'll move on. You can see other benefits as well. One I want to call out is that it strengthens the immune system. It does it through many methods. It probably does it through meditation reduces sympathetic activation, which weakens the immune system. They actually did a study recently, Richard Davidson did a study where he took people, I think, in just an 8-week mindfulness program in a corporate setting. I think it was some kind of Silicon Valley company. I may have gotten the details wrong, but the point is it was a short training for people to do something like 20 minutes of mindfulness a day. At the end of that, they noticed that there was more activation, relatively speaking, in the left prefrontal cortex, which puts the brakes on negative emotions. So the more left frontal activation you get, the more positive emotions you get, generally speaking. Long-term meditators have greater asymmetry of left frontal activation than kind of regular people. Also, people who did this 8-week training amidst a very busy life with no particular contemplative orientation also got a stabilized increase in left frontal activation, and they had a stronger immune system. They, I think, injected them or maybe blew it up their nose. Sorry to be so graphic these days with the swine flu. A little bit of a flu virus, and then watched what their immune system did. Their immune system mounted a stronger response compared to people who did not go through the control group, that did not go through the mindfulness training. It also, very interestingly, it being regular meditation, how many of you meditate at least once a year? All right, good, good. How many meditate once a week, however you call meditation? Okay, or I would include mindful presence in a yoga practice, or Tai Chi or Qigong, okay? Or even daily. How many are up to daily? That's great, great, great. Bows to you. Great vow. I will meditate 1 minute a day or more, no matter what, before I sleep. And keep that vow. That's a great vow. Okay, so guess what? Regular meditation actually leads to, as it shows up here, a greater thickening of the brain, as I was saying earlier. The part that really gets the benefit, the one area, is the insula area. The two area is the executive control of attention, which is involved partly with the anterior cingulate cortex. And the part in the back, the three, that gets lit up a little bit, is somatic awareness. An interesting takeaway, though, is the graph on the bottom, which shows the impact of, these are people, basically people who have a long-term meditative practice but are living in the world. It's not like they're monks or nuns. They're just kind of us, right? This study was about us compared to them. No, I'm just kidding. But the them group is the people that don't have any kind of contemplative practice, the control group, if you will. Notice the graph on the right, which replicates the graph on the left but just has lines drawn in it so you can really see what's going on here. Normally, as we age, we lose cortical volume. In other words, brain cells die. Sidebar, it's actually been recently discovered that new brain cells are born in the normal human brain. There are not a lot of them compared to the large number of brain cells and neurons broadly defined in between your ears, but some are born. But generally speaking, there is a net loss. In other words, it's typical for a healthy 80-year-old to have about 3% or even 5% less cortical volume of the gray matter of the brain than they did on the day they were born. All right. Cortical thinning with aging, kind of a normal process. So the people without a contemplative practice are the red dots, or squares rather. The red squares, if you notice, there's a decline in cortical volume in those three areas with age. See that? Right?
Yep.
Goes down. The people who had a regular meditative practice did not lose cortical volume with age. Amazing stuff. especially with an aging, graying, post-baby boomer population, right? Or baby boomers heading into the twilight zone, right? Encountering the three messengers on the journey through life, maintaining that cortical tissue in those regions of the brain that are worked, which is probably a general point to using other parts of the brain through using other mental activities. One helps preserve cortical tissue. Use it or lose it. Right? Okay. Yeah.
Is there enough research to know whether particular types of meditation are more effective?
Are better than others? Yeah. Right. That's the great question. So the question is there enough research to know? And then I'll do this question, then we'll take a real break, okay? I'll stop teasing you, so I'll repeat the question. The short version is there research that shows that some meditational practices, some methods, are better than others? Obviously better than others towards some end, right? And yeah, there actually is. For example, if you want to kind of really go out and in a kind of a very spacious, non-differentiated, I'm sure very pleasurable state of being that's not very aware of the surround, do TM. On the other hand, if you want to be very present with every moment, so that, for example, a click that gets repeated, the same sound, just repeated, is like a metronome, you know, every, whatever, 8 seconds, every 15 seconds, a click, right? If you want to attend to each click as a new click, do Zen.
Yeah.
Interestingly. Now, both purposes are useful, right? But it is interesting that those two different trainings improve people's capacity to do that. I've also seen a study that distinguishes between different parts of the brain that are activated in kind of the two major types of meditation. I think there are four categories of meditation altogether in my own way of thinking about it. But two of the common types are either absorption practices, like zeroing in on 5 breaths, you know, pardon me, 5 minutes each breath, right? That's an absorption practice, which is a lot of what I'm going to focus on today, are absorption practices and how to support the facilitating conditions for them inside the brain. But the other second, the second major type is open space awareness, where you establish enough stability in the attentional base, often grounded in something like the breath. You know, maybe half your awareness is sort of rested in the breath, or there's always an ongoing sense of the breath. And then there's a witnessing, a being with, or abiding as, the movement of whatever through the open space of awareness, and probably and often a gradual growing sense of awareness itself as the object of, as kind of what's primarily present to the mind. There is a difference between those two in terms of what parts of the brain are activated. I can't remember the exactness of it. I think primarily if you're doing an absorption practice, you're lighting up the anterior cingulate cortex like a Christmas tree in the very beginning. But when you move further in practice, and you'll recognize this if you've ever worked with the jhanas, which are a kind of deep state of absorption, in the second jhana, applied and sustained attention falls away. And at the point of effortless, remember anterior cingulate cortex, effortful attention. At the point that there's effortless attention, when applied and sustained attention fall away, at that point, no one's ever studied this deeply, although we actually have. I'll tell you about that really quickly here. Probably, most likely, activation of the ACC falls away. So in absorption practices, it's lit up until there's complete absorption, right? During open space awareness, there's much more of kind of a lateralized set of networks where there's a little bit of stability, so there's a little ACC activation, but there's mostly just an open-out spaciousness, which interestingly corresponds, probably coincidentally, to lateral activation on the side of networks in the brain. So that's an interesting difference. That said, we know so little. Honestly, I think we're about 30 years in after the invention of the microscope, biologists were, right? Which is, say, around 1650, right? We have these new microscopes that peer in to the head. You know, like the early scientists, microscope invented around 1625, right? Maybe we're around 1725 because we're turbocharged with Western science. Great, but there's so much we don't know. The one thing I will say, our little institute, our nonprofit, has done the first that we know study of a good EEG data and also MRI data on someone who's a jhana master, Lee Brazington, who you may know, and we've tracked him going through what he says, and I'm going to take his word for it, are the four form jhanas and then the four formless jhanas. And what's really interesting, it's an N of one, but it's really interesting that what's going on in the brain plausibly corresponds to the traditional description that are in the Dharma and also were known in the yoga traditions. The Buddha was nested in the great yoga traditions of his time. He was a great yogi, obviously. He had great respect for those traditions. He used much of them in the Dharma. Anyway, those states of mind map to states of brain, even these extraordinary and subtle states of mind. Right? And so we're playing around with that data, squeezing it, making it reasonably good, kicking on it, and then trying to figure out how to get more subjects. So that's pretty neat to see that kind of stuff. Okay. This is the most talky part. I'm really interested in practices. I appreciate your attentiveness. I could really see you using your anterior cingulate cortex to pay attention here. You know, let's take a break. What? Breaks for 15 minutes? Or can you do it in 15 minutes with three bathrooms? Right? Okay. 15 minutes. Let's come back at 11:45.
There's more handouts. I think we ran out of handouts originally, so there's more handouts if people need.